So he asked me to introduce abstract interpretation in a simpler way. So I thought, what can I do? I made my best. And so I had an idea. This is an abstract interpretation. Who can explain which abstract interpretation of what it is? If you have understood the talk this morning, it's completely trivial. What is the objective of this? It's a semantics of that. So this is some software. When you push buttons, it does something. What is the abstraction? You just ignore most button, and you remember 1, 2, 3, 4. And so you take infinitely many buttons. You remember 4 of them. You push them, you do the true action. And the others, you don't know. That's an abstraction. So everything is an abstraction, so we will see some of them. So if I can go to start this stuff, which is there. I have no button for that, it's part of the abstraction. So it's for end users, so it's more or less what users of abstract interpreter static analyzer must understand. And what they must understand is that a static analyzer makes an abstraction, and if things go wrong, it's because of the abstraction. So if you don't know what is an abstraction, you have absolutely no chance to understand what the output of a static analyzer, except if it says, okay, everything is good, but if it says, I don't know, then you have to understand. So you see that I understood this abstraction because there was no button to go into full screen. So because I understand that it's an abstraction, I said, yes, it's not in the abstract. I must go to the concrete. So that's today and tomorrow, same. So it's 3 times the same talk with 3 points of views. So I will explain abstraction by examples. So this morning we started with this wonderful program, and we saw that there were these as a semantic. So we took all the possible, so now I have changed my mind. So this thing is more refined than what we had this morning. Don't we, questions?
There was no time for questions, so here is my question.
Yeah.
Could you just remind us of your definition of test, the definition of model checking and abstract interpretation?
They are all the same.
Interpretation speak about approximation of semantics. If the semantics is finite, the fixed point, you compute it explicitly. And so it's model checking. If it's not finite, you make a finite abstraction, some kind of them will do model checking, others no, I will show examples. And testing is an approximation from below. And unfortunately, from below we cannot say too much up to now. I think someday I will be able, but it's 25 years that I'm thinking every morning, can I do something from below? And for 25 years I say, not today, maybe tomorrow. So now I have infinite traces, which is different from this morning. This morning I say we did only finite observation. Now we observe the full execution until the end. So it's complete traces. And it looks like this morning, except there is this 3 point that say you have to go forever. Now I make a first abstraction to get what I did this morning. I just forget about termination. So to forget about termination, I just take the prefixes of the finite or infinite traces. So I make the finite observation. And if you make a finite observation of a program, it's not enough to say that it will terminate or not. And that's also the same reason that makes that a program cannot check that it will terminate. So I eliminate all this abstraction, take the traces, and just say I will take just the beginnings. And I lose some very important information, which is termination or liveness. And what remains is called safety. So this is then I get what I had this morning, that is all the traces that end either at point 2 or 3, because we can never end at point 4, it's never terminating. And this one includes the one where just point 1. I just start and I stop my observation. So this is an abstraction, and we have lost termination, so my analysis with interval cannot speak about termination because it slots here. So I've done first abstraction. And this one is very simple. You take a set of traces and you just observe the prefixes, just the beginning of all traces that you have. Now I do another one, which was one I did when I moved to this system of equation where I said you have states and you have state attached to points. So I move from prefixes to set of states, and I get this, that is at point 1 you have any state, at point 2 it's positive, at point 3 it's positive, and at point 4 it's empty. This is an abstraction because when I have prefixes I can say x is increasing. I look at all the traces and I look x is taking greater and greater values. If I just take the state that I observe along the trace, I don't remember if x was 10 and then 9, or if it was 9 and then 10. I just remember it was 9 sometime and 10 sometime. So I have lost some information, which is the evolution of the time of the things. But I get all the states that you can reach. So it's reachable state are preserved by this abstraction. So this abstraction is very simple. I take the traces, which are the prefix of the infinite one. I look at the state in the middle and I remember it, and I do this for all traces. Very simple abstraction. And so now I have got something like Floyd proof method or logic, all this stuff, doing this abstraction. Now I make another one, which is an isomorphism. So it's very simple, it's just the same thing presented in two different ways. And this isomorphism says, instead of having a set of states where you have a control state and a value for x, I will project that on a vector which says at program point 1 here are the values, at program point 2 here are the values, and at point 3 here are the values, at point 4 here are the values. So if you have give you that, to get the state, you just say, when I have a point 1, I have any state, when I'm at point 2. So it's a correspondence which is a biunivoc. So I lose no information, but it's very important because I have started to have something simpler. It's simpler to have sets with only integers rather than sets with control and integer. So by doing this projection, I am now able to reason on that at the time and forget the other. So let's go on. So this abstraction is like this. It takes a set of states. The states are pairs control memory, where memory is the value of variable or environment. And what I return is a function which, when you give me the program point, I give you the set of memory values that are possible at that one point. So it's a mathematical representation of that, which is this function with 1, z, 2, this, 3, that, for that. So now we have to abstract these things, which are sets of environment mapping variables to values. So we will do a very big abstraction, which is the Cartesian abstraction. That is, I project along each component of environment. So here is an example. I have two variables, x and y. I have that the value of this variable are these four values. That's not too much. And the projection I do, I say, here are the possible value for x, and here are the possible value for y. And if I do that, I am in this case when you ask me what are the possible value, I say x must be between these two, y must be between these two, so maybe there is a value here that was not there. And there was no value here, but there is one here. So I've lost information by this projection. But if you ask me, is there a value there? I say no. And if you ask me their value there, I say, you say what? You say yes. That's the only question that you are asked by a professor where if you answer, I don't know, it's good. So, and I know that students never want to say, I don't know. They will answer anything, hoping that it's a good thing. So it's the same abstraction that the pointer abstraction. You but you take the possible answer, you pick anyone, and you say, but it might be this one. So Cartesian abstraction, you see I have memory states that map variables to values. And what I have here, I have at each program point, I have a set of environments, so I am just doing this from there to there. And here I have for each variable, I have a set of values. So I must move from function, set of function, to a function mapping the argument of this function to the domain of this function. So I get this very simply. I say, you gave me things here, a set, which were a pair of which was a set of mapping from variable to value, this M, you see, at each program point, so here is I, and to get this one at the same program point, I say you just give me, you give me the name of the value, I look at all possible values and I remember that. All others are lost. So what I have lost is the relationship between variables. Here I have lost the fact that when x is 3, is 1, y must be 3. If I know here that x is there, and I know y is there, I don't know that when x is 1, y must be 3. I have lost this information. So we have made an abstraction. So we go slowly. You see all the abstraction we have done this morning before getting to the interval. So one that we did not do this morning is this one. So I have a set of values here, and the only possible values are these ones. And the abstraction that I do is a parity. So I say, look, these here, they are even. Yes, no, odd, I never know. And here, they are also odd. So x is odd and y is odd. So by doing this abstraction, I introduce these points, but I know that my values are all odd or even. So let's keep that. Now another one is the sign. Oh, so let's move this one, the sign abstraction. So I have my values that are in the green, and I say, very simple, all green on x are greater than 1, and all y in the green are greater than 1. So I just remember the fact that x is positive, strictly positive, and same for y. Or negative, strictly negative, and things like that. So it's more abstract than intervals, but it's finite, so no need for widenings, no narrowing. You can do stupid things, just iterate, it will converge. So yes, so that the lattice, you see, it's 4, 0, strictly positive, strictly negative, different from 0, negative or 0, positive or 0, or I don't know, it's any possible value. So another one that we did not do this morning was constant abstraction. So when you give me a set, I remember if it's empty, I remember if it is a singleton, in which case I remember what is inside, and otherwise I say I don't know. So I see if I do that for set of values of variable, if the variable never gets a value, I will know. If it gets only one value, I will know which one. But if it gets more than one, I will say, I don't know. So that's constant propagation in compilation. So you remember just empty set or one of the possible values for variables, and it's no possible value. And this one is interesting because it has infinitely many abstract values, so it's an infinite set. Or if it's maxing, it's finite, but in math it's infinite. And when I compute my fixed point, I start from bottom, and I have increasing sequences. So if I go increasing, it's always finite. So that's a very interesting case, because I have infinitely possibilities if I take infinitely many programs, but on any given program, I will only go through infinitely many things. So that now if you try to find a finite abstraction of this, you will miss at least one value. For example, you will miss one. You will say, when it's one, I don't know. In fact, you will miss infinitely many. But assume you miss one. Then, because you want the finite lattice, so you, for example, you have this, minus 2 to 2, and you say it's greater than 3, I just say, I don't know. So if you miss any number, there will be a program where this number is useful. And this program, you will not give a good answer because you cannot represent one. So you will say, I don't know. And I will say one. And I will be as fast as you are because it's empty, one, and I don't know. So I will go, I don't know, one, and that's the answer. So that's a kind of proof that if you have a finite lattice, you cannot get results that are as good as if you take infinite lattices. Now, if you take infinite lattices that satisfy this condition of being finite, you cannot get results that are as good as if you do widening narrowing, as by the same reasoning. So let's go now to. So this is a typical example that model shaking cannot do. It's completely trivial. It's an infinite domain. So now let's go to a typical abstraction that is done in model shaking. It's called partitioning. So you have a set of states. So here I have represented infinitely many, but you can put more if you want. I have a property which is a set of states. So I have this blue property. And to get my abstraction, I just partition the set of states into finitely or infinitely many blocks. So here I have taken only finitely many blocks. 9 blocks. And my abstraction say if there is a point in Y block, one block, I remember the whole block. So it's often mysterious to people that taking something larger is easier. Because they say, yes, this was very small and simple to represent in a computer, and this one is bigger, so it's more difficult. And no, if it's bigger, it's simpler, because here I will just have a number, a set of numbers between 1 and 9, even if there are infinitely many sets, states. So it's easier to represent a set of 1 to 9 instead of an infinite subset of an infinite set. So this, I can do sign, because I partition the integers into 0, greater than 1, and smaller than 1. Let's come back to this one. I take this partition, and then by a set of partition, I have the union of these two is different from 0. The union of these two is 0 or negative, and the union of these three blocks is just any integer. So partitioning is a very simple way to represent an abstraction. So you know an abstraction which is not a partitioning. So parity is partitioning. How many abstractions you know? You know three. You have no sign, you know parity, and you know intervals. So if I ask you the question, I know that you must answer. So you just answer interval, and you will be okay. So interval is not a partition. You understand that? Everybody understand? I explain nothing. If you explain. This one is not a partition either. Because if I want, so I will explain. It's also valid for the interval. If I want to have this, I must have the possibility to express minus 1, 0, 1, 2, and any set of blocks, so any subset. So if I take partitioning to do constant propagation, I get all subsets. And so it now it's an infinite set that goes very high. So because in model shaking they do only partitioning abstraction, that's the second reason why they cannot do constant propagation. It's not a partition. And why do they do partition? Because we will see that when you have properties, we have property transformers, it's our equations. And the trick is that if your properties in concrete have a transition system, then when you take a partitioning abstraction, in the abstract it's also a transition system. And so if you have a model shaker that handles transition system, if you do a partitioning abstraction, it will also handle the abstract. Whereas if you do something else, it will no longer work. So that's a limitation. And so any result that you obtain with constant propagation, which is trivial in any compiler, cannot be obtained by model shaking. They have also some other thing which is called predicate abstraction. And that's my next example. And they also have something which is polyhedra, and they cannot make the link between the two. And I will explain why. So let's go to partitioning abstraction. It's very simple. You say you partition, and then you take all the blocks such that the thing that you want to abstract has a point in the block. Very simple abstraction. So I am given a set of blocks, and this choice is difficult, but I assume to be given. And my abstraction is when I want to abstract a set of points, I remember the blocks which have a point in this set. So if we go back here, you see I remember this block because it has this point. I don't remember this one because it has no point inside, and so on. And here I have a representation which is a bit stupid, that is, I represent the block by the set of all their points. So I will take here this set in red, which is not the best way for a computer scientist, but it's isomorphic to the set of blocks, so it's just a problem of computer representation. So now let's go to predicate abstraction. So predicate abstraction can make any finite abstraction. So it can make signs, can make parity. It can make also interval and so on, but then it's not finite, so you have a problem. So it's very simple. You want to have, so you have a set of states as objects by invariance. So you choose a finite number of set of states. And you, by predicates, like, for example, x is positive, y is negative, z is even. You choose this. So I am given this set, and so it's a set of properties, and a property is a set of states that have this property, but you encode it with some logic formula or anything you want. And when you make an abstraction of a set of states, you take all the properties and you look if they are true. So if it's true, it's satisfied by all the points that you want, the set of points that you want to abstract. So if the property you want to abstract implies one of the predefined properties that you have chosen, you remember it. If it doesn't, don't remember it. And then at the end, what you have is the conjunction of all the properties. So your abstraction is you give me properties, and I remember the conjunction of the properties at all at some point. And so for signs, for example, I will take these three points here, and I do intersection, I will get everything. And if I take intersection of empty, no property holes, oh, it's a bit bizarre in mathematics, but this will be give me this one. If I take intersection of these two, I get this one. If I take the intersection of all of them, I get empty set. So, and so any finite abstraction can be done this way, or the other way, which is dual, which says, I take the, here I have, no, it's a partition. So where is it? Yes, here I could have taken the union instead of intersection. So if you want the union for signs, I will take these three, and I will make union, and union of empty will be this one. That's okay, it's equivalent things. So some do union, other do intersection, other do both. It's not better. So the trick is that you can represent this, if the set is finite, you can represent by a Boolean vector, which is 0 if the property is false and 1 if it is true. So this becomes a vector of Booleans, and model checker, they can handle vectors of Booleans. So let's go. So now we have to go to intervals. So the interval abstraction is this. You see, you remember we had properties which is at each program point for each value, you remember the set of its values. We have done all the things, traces, prefixes, invariants, local invariants, Cartesian abstraction. So we arrive there. And now we must go to intervals. So to go to intervals, I will do in two time. I just remember the maximum. And another abstraction is I remember the minimum. And when I put them together, it gives me the interval. So in fact, the way we have programmed this morning, we had maximum and minimum. We could have only done half of it and say the other half is just the dual. So it would have saved line of code. But I did not do that because it confuses people. Anyway, so what is the maximum interval abstraction? Maximum value abstraction? You have a set of states, of values for some variable at some program point. And what I do, I remember the maximum of this set. So I have at each program point, for each variable, I look at all its values and I just remember the maximum. So it's a way, for example, to remember for students, you can remember the tallest one. And if someone enters the room, if it's taller than the tallest one, you say, no, you are not part of the class. And if you are smaller, you say, maybe he's in the class. You don't know. So this one is dual. You just inverse. Instead of great, you take small and larger, smaller, and union, intersection, min, max. So that's the same idea, but for minimum. You remember the smallest one, and if a baby comes, you say, no, you are not from the class. You are smaller than the smallest one. And the biggest professors don't do it, but the smaller they do it, because when you are in small classes, you enter the class of the big guys, and they say, no, you are too small to be there. So the interval abstraction, you take both. So you make the minimum abstraction and the maximum abstraction plus something. So plus something is what is called reduction in abstract interpretation. It is if you do two abstractions, they give information on the other. For example, if the minimum is larger than the maximum, so it is the empty set. And so I have infinitely many ways of representing the empty set here by taking any minimum value which is larger than the maximum. And so what we did this morning, we standardized into one which was empty. It was to avoid this multiple representation. And also, when we make an addition, we add plus one here, plus one here. So we are going to do work which is useless. But by doing the reduction, we will have empty and it will go to empty. So it's very important to do this reduction. So now we go to things that are more precise than the intervals. So one very simple one is octagons. So you see, you take intervals, like this, and you turn 45 degrees and you take interval turn 45. So it's like intervals, intersection, interval turn 45 degrees. So you have only, in two dimensions, you have only eight possible constraints. And so you will approximate this green part by this octagon here. The abstraction is a bit difficult, but I can explain this big formula very simply. So how do I get that this is here, these constraints? So I put it at infinity, and I move it slowly until I touch a green stuff. When I touch a green stuff, I look here, and I say this is less than this value. Now, for this one, I go to infinity, I push it this way, and when I touch a green, I say, aha, x plus or minus, x minus y must be smaller than this value. And I do that for all eight of them. And if it's multiple dimension, I do it for all possibilities, and I get the abstraction this way. So that's the formula that explains that. So now let's go to something that is a generalization of parity. So here you see I have there was a shift from the green to here. So you should shift that here. So you understand that I've shifted my, I don't know if it's one big stuff or many big stuff. Well, I will not correct it now. So you shift the green here, you see, just you take the green, you make it up one square. So now my set is this green point, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And how I approximate them? I take the least congruent that contain all of them. So I say, what is the least congruence in this direction? This one. You see, the least difference is this one. So I say, I repeat this every point here. And now this one, so you shift, I have this difference here, I have the same here, so I have now covered all points, so the difference is 2. And I repeat it this way. So it's a generalization of parity, because parity, we were just saying, do you have plus 2 here? Do you have plus 2 here? No, we say, you have plus something which is constant, and the analysis will discover the constant. Why? Because when you start executing the program, it will have a value. Next time, it will have some other value. This can only be the only constant that will work. Then maybe you will have a third value which is in between, so you will reduce the interval. And because it is integer, when you reduce, it will terminate. So you will find the congruence after some iterations. And here is the lattice, so the picture. Here you have 0 plus 1 repeated. It's any integer, or minus 1 repeated. So here you have even. Here you have, even, odd. So how do you have, I remember that even is even. My old abstraction was it is the inverse of French in alphabetic order. That's not a good way. So it was taking a long time to remember. So now I have a better one, which is even as an even number of letters and odd as an odd number of letters. So it's easier to remember with this abstraction, you see. So this is odd. This is 0 plus 3, so it's 0, 3, 6, 9, to minus 3, and so on. This is 1, 4, And you see that when I go up, I always have finite chains. But when I go down, I may have infinite one. So I don't need a widening, but maybe I will need narrowing. Because when I go down, if I refine, it will be infinite. So the congruence is very simple, you just take the thing that works. It's So the thing that we have seen now, they are a bit of the form of predicate abstraction, but with a little generalization. Because in predicate abstraction, you take predicates, and you just check that they are true, and that's all. Here, I take parameterized predicate. Because the congruence, I say, it's x modulo a modulo b, but I don't take, it can be any a, any b. So the analysis will have to determine the parameters. So my abstraction will be, I take predicate with parameters and a state. I take any number of predicates, and then I can discover the parameter in some way, and then I will have all the states that satisfy this predicate for these parameters. So it's much more powerful than just having no parameter, because with no parameter, you can say either the parameter is 0 or is 2, I fix it to 2, I have parity, or you can say it will be 2 or 5, so I have something modulo 2 or something modulo 5, but you don't have anything modulo any other thing. But also the trick is here I take finitely many such predicates, so I will have here a finitely representable things. So we can do many things like this, predicate abstraction because there is no parameters, congruence because the parameter is x modulo y, interval because the parameters are the bounds, and many other things. So now let's go to something more ambitious, which is an abstraction of this form. That is, I take all values that satisfy some constraint here, and it's a linear constraint. So I can express things. You are inside this polyhedra, or you are inside this one. So to express that, I have constraints like x plus y is greater than 4, x minus 3, y is less than 0, here x minus y is greater than minus 2. And if I just remember these three things, I remember any point here. But the trick is that I have no bound on the number of constraints that I will, or predicate that I will keep. And it is parameterized because this coefficient and constant are the parameters. So it's much more powerful than the parameterized abstraction that we had before because of this possibility of having infinitely many of these predicates. So the abstraction is very simple. That is, you take all the half planes. So you say, I will take all constraints. I try all constraints. And if all the points are on one side only, I remember it. You see, it says, you see, it's a wrong. It's satisfied by all the points. So I remember it. And if it's not satisfied, so for other choice of the parameters, I don't remember it. So here I have given minimal representation, but I also remember these constraints, this one, this one. So you see, it's a problem to remember the minimal number of constraints, and that's algorithms that are not completely trivial, but they are well known since Danzig. So you can do that. And so now we have an infinite set of parameterized predicates that we apply to states and we remember the ones that are true. The trick is now because we move from finitely many to, so we move from predicate, then parameterized predicate finite number, and now we have parameterized predicate infinite number. And now we are in a mess. It's a mess because we may have infinitely many predicates that are valid. And one example is a disk. If you take a disk and you try to approximate by all the constraints, linear constraints that are satisfied, you have infinitely many, which says essentially I am on this side of the tangent. And there are infinitely many tangents. So by making the intersection of all the constraints given by the tangent, I get the disk. So we move to something extremely powerful, and then we cannot, in practice it's very difficult to represent infinitely many constraints, so we will use a widening. So the widening just enforces convergence and also enforces finite representations. So I did not speak about that this morning. So finite abstractions are great because you just do finite abstraction, you put that into a model shaker, you wait long enough, and you have an answer. Because any finite abstraction is a predicate abstraction, so it's very easy to encode that in a... Now, if you think a little more, you see that finite abstraction is not good. We have seen an example with constant propagation. Here is one with interval. So I take this program of this morning. You remember we had 100 here. But I take the family of all these programs which have 100, 101, 102, 10, 0, minus 5, etc. So by moving from n to any constant that you can imagine, I have an infinite family of programs. Now, the result is the following. If you take any of these programs, there is a finite domain with which you can analyze it. How do you do that? You just analyze with interval this morning. We have seen that we get the good answer. Then you remember the predicate that have been used in the interval analysis, and you say, do a predicate abstraction with these specific predicates. So for one program, you will always succeed, provided you give the solution. So the interest of the analysis is very low, because by giving the predicates, you have given the solution, and the analysis are just made union intersection, which is not a great business. So if you give the solution, you find it. Now if you don't give it, and you resort to a finite domain, there will be one of these n at least for which you will fail. Because there are infinitely many intervals to express, it's 0 to n. Because you have a finite domain, there will be a missing one. And by taking, you have intervals, you have things that are more complicated, but there is one you cannot express. So I take n plus 2 for the one you fail on. So you will fail also, plus 3 you will fail. So you fail for infinitely many of them. And you know from this morning that taking any n, we will have the answer with intervals. So it shows that if you take a finite domain, there will be infinitely many programs on which the interval will give you a solution that you cannot obtain by choosing this finite domain. So what you can do is just try a finite one and say, ah, it did not work with 10, so let's take 11. And then you say, ah, with 11 is not enough, let's take 12. And that's what is called refinement. So people doing model shaking with abstraction with refinement, they do that. They include more and more predicates. And the trick is that then it no longer terminates. So if no longer terminates, we know that they will have programs on which they will not terminate and on which we will terminate. Because we always terminate with intervals. So another reason for failing. Let's go. So what we have seen is interesting. It's a hierarchy of abstractions. And that's very important because abstract interpretation is all over defining how I abstract. So we have seen the alpha and how the abstraction compare. So here it's identity. I abstract nothing. Here it was traces, so prefix traces, I forget termination. Here I have an abstraction we have not spoken about. Here it's invariance, that is set of states that you can reach. So then here you have one which is polyhedral abstraction, which is more precise than octagons, which is more precise than intervals. And here you can do the Cartesian abstraction that project, and it is more precise than interval because interval is the further abstraction, but it's not comparable to octagon because octagon will give you relationship between variables, whereas Cartesian will never give you any relationship. So we had the predicate abstraction here, which are in fact all finite abstraction. And with all finite abstraction, you can do parity, you can do signs, but you cannot do congruence. And congruence are not comparable to interval. They don't give you any, not, one is not more precise than the other. And congruence is more precise than parity because here it's only modulo 2, whereas here it's modulo nothing. And then you have the universal abstraction. When you are asked a question, you always answer, I don't know, which is a good strategy at least one day in the course. How long do I have now? 10 minutes? 15? Yeah, it's okay. So I will skip this one because we do that tomorrow. So I will, I'll go to... So I will go to some applications. Tomorrow I will redo what I was planning to do now. It was an introduction so that you can sing for tomorrow, but you will have forgotten during the night. I'm sure, so it's useless. So one example is ASTRAE, which is a nice abstract interpreter I mentioned this morning, which works for embedded system and control command systems. So if you are European, you remember the failure of Ariane. If you are American also, because you were laughing at European failing. I was also laughing at the people from Ariane. And I remember when I was in my office with my student, and I told them, maybe it's a great news for us because it's an error that we can catch by abstract interpretation. And that was the case for some reason. Here is one where we were laughing, Europeans, and Americans were not laughing, in the Patriot missile, who was doing some error that killed the other Americans, unfortunately, because of rounding. No. This one we were really laughing, because it's an error on units. So on the satellite they were using English units, and on the ground they were using metric unit or the contrary, and so it did not fit. And so when you say I am this distance in feet, you just convert in meter, it's very far. And so they say both go down and roughly splashed. So I often told this story to European engineers, and they say, we don't have this conversion problem. But they have. They have because if you have a meter, it's 100 centimeters. So if your colleague have given you his length in centimeters, you say, I know only on meters. So you divide by 100. And when you divide by 100, it's not a power of 2, so you make some error. And this error can accumulate over time, and at the end you can have exactly the same result. So I will show maybe example of that. So introduction to the hard life of the miserable programmer. You know all this. We have seen this morning integers are not integers. So here is a factorial program that is tested on 3 and 4 and gives wonderful result. And when I test on 100, it gives 0. And when I test on 20, it gives a negative number, which is counterintuitive, but it's perfectly explainable by any programmer who knows the dangers of integers. If that integers are represented modulo the maximum integers in 2's complement, because it's good for hardware, to increment, you just increment in binary, same here. To increment, you increment in binary. The problem is you have add to this number, you get so maxin plus 1 is minint. Well, that's a detail, and that's why I got a negative number. And also you can add 1, add 1, add 1, add 1, and get to 0, so I get also the 0. So when you look at the function which is computed by my little program, it's factorial n up to n equal 12, and then it's something modulo. It's not factorial modulo, it would be too simple. It's the way I compute factorial doing modulo on the way, which is not the same as factorial modulo. So it's a kind of random function at some point. And if you look at OCaml, you get this wonderful recursive program, and you see that they are the same up to 12, and then sometimes they are the same, and some other time they are different. So you know the answer. Yeah, you are laughing.
I told you this morning, I had this problem. You were not listening.
There is a bit for garbage collection. So in C, 32 bit or 64, and here it's 31 or 63. And so when you do the modulo, it's not the modulo the same number, and so it doesn't give the same answer. Except that sometimes modulo is okay, it's a power of 2, it might, can be the same. So if you want to be serious, you have to say there is no overflow here, no overflow here. So you have to rewrite it this way. So I check everything here, and I return 0 when it's greater than, when there is an error. I return 0. So this function looks much better. And you give it to Astray, and it says no error. So I was very happy with that. And then I looked at the output of Astray. You see, I check, I launch Astray, and then I grab the warning. And I was very happy, and I gave lectures with that. And someday I look at the file which is produced by Astray, and it was saying, your Astray version is out of date. And so... I got no answer, and so there was no warning. So I phoned to my young, and I said, when it's out of date, you must warn out of date. And so these slides are out of date, and the only way, because we have a multiplication which is very hard to handle because it's not linear, and this never happened in the program we consider. We don't do anything for that. And so here you have to say, unroll the loop forever. And so if you unroll the loop, Astray will make it. So you have one more parameter to put. So reals. So engineers think about real. At school, you go reals, and in reality, reals are not reals because they are floats. So floats are more or less like this. There are many floats close to zero, and the larger you are, the less floats you have. So if you have big floats, you have a big difference. So it's normalized, everything. There are huge reports, IEEE something. And let's try x plus a minus x minus a, which in math is usually 2a. And so I take a is 1. I take this magic number. I do x plus a, x minus a. I print the difference, and I get this big number instead of 2. Then I just do one thing. I change this 8 into a 7, and then I go 0. Engineers are okay. They say 0 is close to 2. The previous one, they say, no, that's not possible. And what is the problem in this one? I have subtle declarations here because I have floats, and these are doubles, and so there is an interaction between the two. So I have my x with the 8. It is just in the middle of two numbers that are floats, and they are distant from this big number. And now I do IEEE, so IEEE say you do the real things, so x, I get x plus 1, and then you do some rounding. So, and here I choose rounding to the closest, so it goes there. Then the other one I do in the real, then I do real rounding to the closest one, and then I make the difference and I get this big number. Now if x is not exactly in the middle, it's somewhere here. So what happens is you increment and decrement, and they go the rounding the same side, either this side or the other side, and so the difference is zero. So if you do testing, you have two times the number I have given possibilities where you will get zero, so it's almost always zero, and just one case when it's a middle, you get this big number. So the probability of observing this is 10 minus 18 or something like that. So this means you will never observe it. So testing is no good. So let's ask to Astray. So you have this number, you see plus 1, minus 1, and I ask to Astray to say what is the value of the result, because Astray does not handle prints. In control command, you never print anything, you just control some object, so you don't print. And it says almost good, because we got this number, or zero, and here we also get minus. So who knows why? D'envie. Do you know why?
You were not listening. It's because...
In IEEE, you have four rounding. You have toward zero, toward plus infinity, toward minus infinity, and to the closest. And Astray doesn't know which one will go in your machine because you have an assembler code, a special instruction. You say to your machine, please change your rounding, and any other one can change it. And if you are not lucky, this other one that changed will have some influence on you. It depends on the machine you have. And so we take the worst case. We say, maybe the greatest one will be rounded there, the smallest one will be rounded there, and the difference will be negative. So by doing so, we are not subject to errors due to rounding moving at any time. So here is, maybe I'm late now. How much I have? Zero? 5 minutes, including questions? So I skip the exercise, very interesting. I skip this one, arrays. So arrays is interesting. I take this program. You see I have an array of one element, I have an integer, very large, and I take the nth element of this array of one. I take my machine, favorite machine, my old Macintosh, my new Macintosh, and PCs, and you see I get four different answers. So this means that the semantics of this program is not defined. It can be very different from one machine to the other with the same compiler. It's the same compiler. So what do we do in that case? If this happens, we say we stop. So this means that because we will stop, if you make an error later, we will not find it. That's not good. So we also say you must have no alarm which is of this type where we don't know, for which you get a message. If you don't have these errors of the third type, then your analysis is correct. Otherwise, it is correct up to the time where you do the first error, and then it's not considered. And we have not found any solution for that. So Astray, when you put false behind, which is an error, will give you the first error. And you see here also that we handle memory byte by byte, because it's C, so you have pointer arithmetic and all this stuff, you must handle that. And so we never signal this error because execution stops here for our semantics. So Astray, very nice, works well, scales, and I go through many domains. I go through interesting ones. No, I just keep this one. I go to the specialized domains. So you have this kind of abstraction, which is an ellipsoid, because there are things that you cannot capture by linear things. There are behaviors that you cannot capture by linear things. So here is an example. It's Simulink here. It's a filter. I have run the filter, and you see that the set of states move into an ellipse here. And if we approximate that by anything which is polyhedral, at one iteration we will say it's here, and at the next iteration it will turn and shrink. When it turns and shrinks, you have a point outside. So you get a larger one. Next one, it will turn and shrink, you get a larger one, and by widening you will get no information. But if you have an ellipse, you turn and shrink, it remains in the ellipse. And so it's stable. So it's an example where there is absolutely nothing to do but enriching the abstraction. Because if you are only linear, you will never make it. And if you do model checking, you will get that. Point after point, you will get a value, a counterexample. It does not work for this point, this one, this one, this one, this one, and this will go forever. Except if the model checker is able to say, ah, my God, it's an ellipse, I will do the abstraction, implement it, and run, encode it in Booleans and run it. I know nobody doing that. And so then we project, when we have the ellipse, we project here, and we get bounds. So here is an example of such a bound, which is absolutely not trivial. You ask to your best student to find this from this program, to give a bound here, it will be wrong. So, and why engineers are happy? Because we find bounds that are better than they do usually. So they are about the same as they have, because they don't take rounding errors into account and things like that. So usually you are a little larger. But it's almost the same, so they are very happy. They say, wow, that's a great tool. And here I have tried CBMC, which is a model checker. You see it iterates 95,000 times and then says I have no more memory to put one more point. So another thing here is exponential. That is, in control command, you have things that evolve in time. For example, the accumulation of rounding errors. You can accumulate rounding errors, and you must bound them, because if you go forever, this will do an overflow at some point. And so one way is to be very brute force. You take an exponential, and you say, well, it's like this, or like this, or like this, and it's below. And here is an example that you can only handle with an exponential. So it's kind of Barry Center. You have an object that is moving in the sky, and you try to see where it is more or less by seeing where it has been before and not change too much. And there is a rounding error, because this coefficient here create some rounding error for some reason that I... it's a power of 10, 5, yes, maybe it's... Yeah, anyway, there is a rounding error. And you see the invariant which is found, it says the absolute value of p is less than an exponential. So you have a constant, to ignore that, plus something, and here you have a LaTeX error, and power... Power clock. So it's a power clock. And in LaTeX it becomes power clock, French style with so anyway. So this is an exponential that grows slowly. And here you see it's a control, a real-time program. So you have while true iterate. And do this program. From time to time you reset, the pilot is pushing the button to reset the computer, so it restarts here to some value, otherwise you iterate. And here you wait for the next clock tick, that is every 5 milliseconds you do this, then you wait for next 5 milliseconds, then you do this, you wait for next 5 milliseconds, you do this. How do you know it's 5 milliseconds? It's because when you have a plane and you want to brake, you see, you know these rules, you in plastic, if you shake them, they will break. You have done that one time in your life, I'm sure. If it's long enough, you shake fast enough, it will break. Planes, the whale, they're the same. So they break one, and they count how long it takes. Then they know that they did 100 measures to discover the phenomenon, and they divide the time by 100, and they find some number. Then they say, we will make some security. And if they find 20, they will find, say, 5 is okay, 5 milliseconds. So that's the tick. And I know here, so this one is 10 milliseconds, and it's flying for 10 hours. So I have my exponential like this, but the time is 10 hours. So the maximum value is 23. You see the reasoning? So when we go back here, the maximum, so that's time. That's the value of x as a function of p as a function of time. It's an exponential. If I know the maximum here, I look there and I get 23. So I know there is no overflow, no possible overflow. So it's a very rough reasoning because we have not really understood what it does, but a very rough abstraction makes the result. So I skip all of that. And I was very ambitious, huh? So it worked. It works on 3 examples. That's a lot of work. So one is the family of Airbus plane, not including the one that broke recently. And I know now they are running the software on this one, and they have found no errors because we analyze only the control command. We don't analyze the instrument they buy from outside. And the thing that failed were more or less something which is called a pitot. It measures the speed, it goes to some computer, and there might be a bug there, but we don't have the program. And another one that we did that for the 340-600, then the 380, then the ATM that goes to the international station to give food, and then we make it commercially available. So the last slide says, just you can buy it now. So you see that the only program tested on 3 examples and then sold. But it took 7 years to handle these 3 examples without false alarm. So I have 0 minutes for a non-question. Olivier, you have another one?
At the beginning of the school, there was a guy called Ras Bodhi who was telling us how you could construct programs based on invariants or probabilities or things like that. And you are taking the dual approach, a little bit like Church and Curry. Could you comment on that?
Yes.
Because if you are a researcher, you can be of two kinds. One, you can say, the world is not good and I will change it. And then you have no success in industries. You have success with a lot of your colleagues that think also that they should change the world. Or you say the world is as the world is, and if I want to have a success, I must adapt myself to the world and do what engineers do. So when we went to see the people of Airbus, they came to see us. They say, you must take the program as it is. You are not allowed to make any modification on it, not even include a comment in it. And we want 0 false alarm. Can you do it? I said, yes, maybe in 10 years. It took only 7. So I was pessimistic. But I could have said, yes, you start from simulating, then we should do an analysis of the simulating time, then you translate in scale, so we should redo in scale, then the translation from scale with real to C is wrong, so you should do something. And at the time, they would have said no, because you have to go through the hierarchy of the people that do the testing, the people that do the compilation, the people that do scale, the people that do simulating, the people that do the model, and that's, say, 3,000 or 4,000 people you have to go through. So they would have said no. But now they say, you have had success on C, we would like to anticipate the bugs because we have found bugs which are design bugs. That is, at the time of the design, they made a bug, and this decision propagates through all translation, and at the end, you get a C code on which you can do nothing. Your bug is there still the beginning. So the only way is to change the model at the origin. And this bug, you have it here, the last that I gave, because it's a control loop that does not go outside. And in control theory, if you make a control loop that remains in the program itself, that leads to instabilities. So they are lucky that it's not unstable, at least for flight time. But if it goes larger, it becomes unstable. So it's a conceptual bug. And so they thought, if we had that before, it would have been great. So now that we have proved that we can do something, they are ready to say, yes, we will spend some time with you to go to earlier design phase. But they have to convince all the hierarchy, which is extremely difficult. Now, if you look at Popple, for example, someone told me, and in Microsoft, it's a frustrated guys on languages. None of the language come from Popple, maybe except ML. They all come from outside. So if you work on programming languages and say, I'm going to change the world, the probability of success is very small. On the hand, I would advise you to do that because it's a much easier solution. You don't have any criticism. You have no timing. If you fail, you can say, I will do better next time. Whereas if you go to industry, you have to handle pointer arithmetic. You cannot say this style of programming is forbidden by my rules, because they have rules. And when you check them, they don't apply their rules, because they have no tools to check semantic rules. So, and they have no one that understands them to check them. So you cannot limit the stupidity of programmers. And so either you go to the true stuff or you remain an idealist. So I've been idealist for 25 years and then realistic for 7. And now the whole thing I wish is to go back to idealist situation, because it's too difficult to be realist. Are you happy with my answer? In which side would you put yourself?
On the same time, I think. So who is not an idealist here? I'm no longer. So a realist guy, I'm no longer a realist. I'm back in the idealist side.
No other question? Time for a break. Thank you.